Michael Jordan is not only the best basketball player, but he's the most exciting basketball player to ever play.
Tatum fires away, pumps it in! 51 for Jason Tatum!
The Big Three NBA Podcast is powered by Prize Picks, the exclusive daily fantasy partner of the CLNS Media Network.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Big Three NBA Podcast. A'Shaun Blakely here, Gary Washburn, and myself, Fani Lunas. Let's get into it already. The Celtics back in the series. They take control in game three in Miami. Miami just scored 12 points in that first quarter. Tatum with 22 and 11. Brown and 22 and 8 rebounds. What do you make of this bounce back? I get people were being a little dramatic after one loss, but how big of a turnaround was it for Boston playing in Miami?
They did what they're supposed to do. This is what you do when you have the fourth best record in franchise history. This is what you do when you have the best record in the NBA. You go into somebody's building and you lay the smackdown on them, particularly when they're a team like the Miami Heat, which you know has historically had your number, particularly in the playoffs. So it was a good win. It was a convincing win. And the thing that impressed me the most about this win was that I didn't think the Celtics played great basketball. I thought they played good. I didn't think they played great basketball. And even though that they won by 20 points, there's clear and undeniable room for growth.
Yeah, I thought it was a good win, way to respond from Joe Mazzulla, just and the entire team. It just wasn't Mazzulla who needed to respond. The entire team needed to respond. Being a aggressive team, the more passionate team, playing well, playing cohesive, playing strong defense, all of the above, and then letting the offense take care of itself. I mean, the offense, they're going to be able to score points in games, but they need to stop Miami. And Miami has now scored 94 points in game one, 84 points in game two, game three. So you have to stop them. You have to limit their open looks. You have to just play together defense, play with that passion, get all the loose balls, hustle plays, 50-50 balls, all that. The Celtics punch first, jumping out to a 12-3 lead. Like Kwani said, holding them to 12 points in the first quarter. Miami could never really recover. And that's what you have to do. You got to stomp these dudes out. Like, you can't take it easy, take the foot off the gas, chill, think, oh, they're shorthanded. They're going to, you know, you literally have to play with that passion for the rest of the series to get these guys out of there.
Yeah. And just to add on to what Gary's talking about, I thought the way that they handled Miami's shooters, particularly in sticking with that drop coverage, which I'm not a big fan of the drop coverage, because I think you're playing with fire. You're giving teams, I think, more space to shoot than you probably should. But their ability to close out on pretty much every shooter that Miami was looking to get going early on was so pivotal. When you look at Tyler Hero, he was like 0 for 5 in the first quarter. And none of the five shots he took were good looks. And that's what you want if you're the Celtics. Tyler Hero specifically is a guy that when he gets it going, he becomes damn near impossible to slow down. But the trick is, when he's off, he's ridiculously off. Like, he was 5 for 16 for the game, never got into any kind of flow or rhythm offensively, and that threw everything that the Miami Heat were looking to do off. Same thing for Jovic, who had a really good game too for them. He was also a non-factor, and he was another guy that they tried to get going early as well. So the Celtics' ability to not just be in the right positions in terms of guarding their men, but also closing out on shot attempts, I thought that was such a big deal for them in game three, something that we didn't see them do nearly as good a job with in game two.
Another thing we've talked about all season, obviously, is the Celtics' depth, their bench. So how would you say the bench played a role in that game three win as well?
Gary?
I thought the bench was solid. Peyton Pritchard made plays, hit a couple of shots, had one of those little pesky putbacks that he does. Sam Hauser knocked down a three and also played good defense. Al Horford, those guys contributed. Those guys are all non-factors in game two for whatever reason. And I felt like the bench pitched in, contributed. It was an all-around good effort. They only scored 104 points, so they didn't have this masterful offensive game. And we've seen them be much better offensively, especially in the second half. I think they scored 41 points in the second half. They're going to need to be better down the road in the second half. Like, they have to be more efficient, you know. But it was most definitely good enough to win. You would have liked to have seen them maybe pull away a little bit more. But you know what? You can't ask for everything. Playoff basketball is hard. You're facing a very quality and tough opponent. So, but I thought the bench came in, did exactly what they're supposed to do, add a spark, play defense too. It's not just scoring the ball, it's playing defense. And I thought Hauser, Horford, and Pritchard, who are, you know, and even Cornette hit a couple of free throws in his first minutes back. He played 5 minutes, but, you know, 7 points from Pritchard, 9 from Horford, 5 from Hauser, plus 15 for Hauser, plus 15 for Horford. Exceptional performance, considering that it was just a balanced effort. 4 scores in double figures, but I just felt like the bench was a big plus in game three.
Yeah, and the thing that I liked about the bench was that Joe Mazzulla didn't wait to get them in the game. He played 9 guys in the first quarter, and that's a little bit unusual in a playoff game to see that many guys play so early, and not that be something that you've been doing all season. And, you know, part of it, I think, had to do with Porzingis picking up those 2 quick fouls, but I think a bigger part of it was that Joe was looking for, I think what Gary pointed out, a spark. They, even though they were playing great defense, they still need to be connected, both the starters and the bench. And so some of the good things you saw defensively out of that starting unit, they were looking, I think, for a little bit of an offensive spark from that bench, with something that Peyton Pritchard and Sam Hauser have been pretty good at most of the season. But in this particular game, it was Al Horford who was given that offensive juice with his ability to knock down shots and things of that nature. And that's what this team is going to have to do. You know, their bench doesn't have to go out there and get you 25, 30, 40 points as a group. They have to make an impact. And that was not the case in game two. You go back to game two, Peyton Pritchard took the same number of shots as you, Kwani, as you, Gary, and I combined. And that should never happen. Never, ever, ever, ever should that happen. And so it was good to see him look to shoot. I mean, forget about the points he scored. Just take a damn shot. That's what we're looking for. And same with Sam Hauser. I thought they didn't use him nearly as much as they should have in game two. And to me, Sam is a specialist. He's a guy that he's becoming a solid defender, not spectacular, not all NBA defensive. He doesn't get torched. He may not stop everyone, but he's not a – let's put it this way. He ain't Luka defensively. He ain't that dude. Sam is a solid defender who also has a specialty. He's a knockdown three-point shooter. And I thought the Celtics, they did a good job of leaning on that a little bit more than I thought they did in game two. And that's, again, it's one of the main reasons why the Celtics did not play a great game, and yet they still won by 20 on the road. And to me, that's what the second unit gives you the luxury of being able to do. Come into the game, not score a ton of points, but definitely make an impact with their presence to help buffer a not-so-great game by the starters. Defensively, the Celtics were lights out. But overall, it was an okay game. It wasn't a great game, but it was an okay game.
Yeah, Sharon, you mentioned Mazzulla putting in bench players earlier. What would you attribute to, when you think about the win itself, to the win? Is it more of a Joe adjustment is the factor, or the fact that the Celtics just maybe use more of the depth in general?
I'm going to throw my 2 cents in, but I really want to hear what Gary got to say. Because you're talking about Gary's boy, Joe. So I went back, I looked at the game afterwards just because it was an earlier game, so I had time. And I felt that the players were more leading the charge, because I think what Joe did more than anything else was reiterate who they were and made sure that they were reminded that when you do what you're supposed to do, when you do what our game plan is, you're going to win, and you're going to win comfortably. But I thought it was the players that I think really kind of supercharged their play in that game at both ends of the floor. I mean, when you look at just the way they were defending, I just remember just watching the game from home, you know, there would be, when a timeout was called, there was a consistency with you know, guys like Jason Tatum talking to Sam Hauser about something, and it was clearly they were talking about something defensively. Same thing with Jaylen Brown. There was a level of communication among the players on the floor that seemed to be a bit more heightened than what we saw in game two. And so while I think Joe did a good job of just kind of setting the table, it was the players that made sure everyone ate good. It was the players that made sure everyone was defensively speaking where they needed to be. And that's what a team is about, because if Joe Mazzulla did nothing, I think you might have saw a similar result to game two. We'll talk a little bit more about just, you know, game four coming up, but it was really good to see that the players and the coach seem to be kind of on the same page in terms of how we're going to approach this game. What are we going to do defensively? And what are we going to get from everyone? What is everyone bringing to the picnic today? And Joe was among those that brought a little something to the game. But I think the players brought more.
Yeah, I agree with Sherrod. I thought Mazzulla was steady during the break, 3 days off. And I think he instilled in his guys, listen, we need to be more forceful, play with more fortitude, play with more passion, be able to take control of this game, like right away, punch first, don't let them get comfortable. And they don't have enough scoring talent to be able to score on the Celtics' top line defense. They just don't. The Celtics are willing to let Adebayo go for his, step back 16 footers. But you're going to run Tyler Hero off the three-point line. And obviously, their aggressive defense, their physical defense, got him frustrated. Duncan Robinson was a non-factor. Kevin Love barely played. Haywood Highsmith, who can shoot, turned into more of a driver. They ran him off the line. He hit a couple of floaters and layups. And that's fine. They're like, okay, you can hit your twos. Jovic, same thing. Jaime Jaquez missed all three of his attempts. So this is a situation where the resistance increased and Miami bent. Miami was not the same team. And I think that was a combination of the players and the coach. I think Mazzulla said, you guys know what you have to do. And the players came together and said, listen, we know we're the better team. We know we're playing 100% engaged, no lapses. There's not many teams on the earth that can beat them. And I know that. So go out there and prove it. I don't care if the game is in South Beach, Miami, you know, Cuba, wherever the game is. It didn't matter what's on the road. They punched first. They took control. They took the crowd out of the game, and they cruised to a win. And it was just like game one, Sherrod. They didn't play their A offensive game. 41 points in the second half, 3 for 16 from the three-point line in the second half. They got outscored in the second half, but when you're up 24 points, you can do that. You can have that little bit of a drop-off when you continue, as a guy said at practice today, they continued to play defense. The defense didn't slip. The offense wasn't great in the second half. I mean, Jason had 7 points in the second half. Jaylen had 12. Like, they did not – they're not going to be superstars in this series, okay? Like, Miami's not going to let them go for 40 each and cruise. Maybe another series, maybe the next series, maybe a series after that. This is going to be a grinded-out series. This is not going to be pretty, but that's fine. As long as you play defense, play physical, let them feel you, you're going to win this series. So I feel like it was the players just as much as the coach.
This is Sherrod Blakely with the Big 3 NBA Podcast, and I wanted to talk to you about Prize Picks, America's number one fantasy sports app with more than 3 million members. It is the easiest and most exciting way to get in on the action while you watch your favorite sports teams and players compete. You just pick more or less on two or more player stats and watch the winnings roll in. Get in now on a playoff action and win up to 100 times your money on Prize Picks as you and the world's best players take the game to a new level during basketball's postseason. You can now win up to 100 times your money on Prize Picks with as little as 4 correct picks. Yes, just 4 picks can multiply your money big time. You can turn that $10 investment into a $1,000 win with basketball, hockey, and other sports entries today on Prize Picks, America's number one fantasy sports app. As a longtime fantasy league player myself, Prize Picks is the perfect what's next to satisfy my fantasy league itch. You want in too? here's what you have to do. First, you got to go to prizepicks.com/CLNS and use the code CLNS for a first deposit match up to $100. That's right, prizepicks.com/CLNS. Use the code CLNS for a first deposit match of up to $100. So, that being said, you get a chance to pick more. You can pick less. It's that easy.
Thing, Gary, I wanted to just kind of get you to get your thoughts on this. It feels as though all season long, this team has been built around scoring because they've got so many different options in that regard. And yet here we are in the playoffs and they're up 2-1 because of what they're doing on the defensive end of the floor. What are your thoughts on how they are balancing those two worlds? Because the Celtics, I think on the broadcast, they said something about the Celtics, I think maybe the first team in NBA history to finish in like the top three, offensive and defensive rating back-to-back years, something like that, which makes a lot of sense when you look at just how they play and just the results that they put up. But how do you think they've gone about balancing those two things? Because if I'm not sold that they're as good at balancing the two as their stats might indicate. But what are your thoughts on that?
I think when they hit shots, I think they can tend to coast a little bit and rely too heavily on their offense. I think they know when they're locked in and 100% engaged and knocking down on shots offensively, White, Horford, Brown, Tatum, when they're knocking down threes and they can score 135, 140 points, they know that they don't need – their defense doesn't need to be as engaged and locked in. They know they can win a game 130 to 110. But I just think these games they've had to be locked in defensively. Not because Miami has a great prolific scores, but Miami's just pesky enough to be able to hang in the game, muck up the game. They have a great coach. They have a well-disciplined roster to be able to muck the game up. And they know that if they catch the Celtics slipping, because that's how they're going to have to win, catching the Celtics slipping, being lackadaisical, having those lapses. If the Celtics don't lapse, especially defensively, they know they can win any game. And they can have their C game offensively because they have so many scores. They have even guys like Jrue Holiday. They have guys like Al Horford and Peyton Pritchard who can come in and deliver 10, 18, or 15, 16 points on any given night. The same with Derek White, in addition to Tatum and Brown. So I think they have to realize, and I think they're starting to realize, we're a defense-first team. We cannot be an offense-first team throughout this playoffs and postseason expect to win a championship. We've got to focus on stopping other teams and the offense to take care of itself. I think they entered game one with that mentality, and I think they entered game three with that mentality. I don't know what the hell happened in game two.
They don't know what the hell happened in game two.
Right. I don't think anyone did. But Porzingis, also game two, he didn't show up. He didn't know what was going on. But game three was his bounce back game. He had 8 points in the first quarter of game three when, as we know, in game two, he had 6 points total. So what adjustments did you guys see him make in game three? And what should Boston be expecting from him for the rest of the series?
Are you on a scene? What did you see? Curious.
Well, I thought he got going early, hit a couple of threes. He made sure he said it was a tough couple of days in reflection, having such a bad game, then losing him going 1-for-9, just him not being himself, him being a minus 32 in his 30 minutes. So I just think he got going quickly. He made himself a presence. I think he scored more points in the first couple of minutes than he did all of game three. I'm sorry, game two. Yeah. So he was just a presence. And once you get him to be a presence, it opens everything else up. So I just thought he was more confident, more aggressive, more assertive. And like he said, quit getting frustrated. Quit talking about the officiating. I know he felt like he got fouled. He felt like he got slapped and touched in game two. And, they were pushing him around. You know what? Get over it. Get tougher. Grind that out. Get through it and you'll be fine and the rest will take care of itself. And I think that's what he literally understood, that he had to be a little bit tougher, a little bit more focused in game three.
I think one of the things that we sometimes forget about Kristaps is that he's relatively new to this high stakes world of playoff basketball. Usually this time of year, when we're talking about like late April, he's in 1-2-3 Cancun mode. Because the teams he played for, they're literally not playing at this point. So I think for him, there's a bit of an adjustment of understanding, embracing the not just the opportunity, but just the challenges that come about when you are playing high stakes playoff basketball. How do you deal when you're getting a bad whistle? What are some of the counters that you need to implement when things aren't going your way? What can you provide and bring to the table that they're taking away, but you can still give him some of this or that or the other? Those are some of the things that he is going to be working through. And I thought it was a good experience for him in game two because he knows what it looks like to play poorly. And now he has a better idea of what he needs to do in that, and when he's going through that, in order to right the ship in game versus righting the ship after you lose. And so for me, that's the thing that I like most about Kristaps in game three was his recognition of what he needed to do better and his willingness to look at ways to just frankly impact the game in a way that maybe isn't in his sweet spot. Like he loves when teams play zone, he loves to set up camp right in the middle because he knows he can just more times than not shoot right over the top of guys. But what Miami did, they forced him out a little bit further away from getting to his sweet spot. And what wound up happening was when he would get the ball there, all of his shots were pretty much contested. So what did he do? He stepped further away and got behind the three-point line, spent a little bit more time behind the three-point arc, I thought, than he normally does. And the result was he knocked down a couple shots, and that opened things up for some of those other driving angles and lanes for his teammates. And so even though his numbers were significantly better, I mean, when you score 18 points on 5-for-9 shooting, that's pretty damn efficient. It opened up things for Tatum and Brown to attack, for Derek White to get going, a guy that I just don't think they utilize him enough when they really should. But Porzingis, I thought, opened up opportunities for so many other guys when he was able to get his game going. And again, I think he did it a little bit differently. So I'm curious to see how does Miami adapt to that? Because if Porzingis is setting up shot behind the three-point line, you can't give him that shot. And Porzingis, I think, now realizes that if they're going to close hard on me, pump fake, dribble drive, pull up, or pump fake, dribble drive, and find someone. I think now Porzingis is understanding that I can't go to my bread and butter, camp in the lane of that zone and just catch and try to shoot over guys because they're pushing me out. They're not letting me get that comfortable. So if he's figuring out what he can do to impact the game offensively more than he already has this season, that becomes another hole in the ship for the Heat to try to plug. And I just don't think they can do that. And this is exactly why Porzingis was so important to this team and why when you look back at last year's squad and you look at this year's, you look at all the new additions, there is none more important than Kristaps Porzingis because he is the one guy that Miami, when he's playing his game, they have no answer for. And we saw that play out in game one. We saw it play out again in game three. And I suspect we'll see it play out in the next couple of games as this series begins to wind down.
So with that point made, what are the expectations for the Celtics in game four other than to actually win the game?
I think this might be blowout time. And they won some pretty convincing games already. But I think there's like that regular season Celtics beatdown. I'm not going to call a 50-burger win, but I would not be surprised. Gary, they've won three games by 50 or more points. Don't act like you don't know.
Sherrod, question. What's a 50-burger wing?
Win.
We hungry. I heard a wing.
Burger. Okay, got you. 50 win. Okay.
It's a 50-burger win.
Victory.
Continue. Okay.
But the Celtics won more games like that than anyone in a single season in NBA history. I don't think they'll beat Miami that bad, but I do think that the Celtics have one of those games in them because they haven't had one yet. We're three games into this, and the Celtics really haven't had that one signature clicking at both ends of the floor kind of game. And Miami had that, and they won that in game two. And the scary part about game two, if you're at Miami, is that the Celtics basically needed maybe an average game from Porzingis, and they probably beat you, even though you played a great game. So I think the Celtics have that big blowout-type performance in them, and we may see that on Monday. We may see it in Game 5 back in Boston, but it's going to come at some point. And so that, to me, is what going into game four, I'm looking to see, are the Celtics going to get out to one of those, you know, like a 23-6 run or something like that, or have that stretch where Miami just can't stop them and can't score against them? Because that's one of the benefits of having a team that's elite at both ends of the floor. You can literally create a blowout in about 2-3 minutes because they can't get anything going either way. They can't stop you and they can't score on you. So I do think game four might be a little bit more lopsided than people think. And it's not so much that the Celtics have found some secret sauce. It's just that Celtics have gone back to the original flavor that they are about. And that is, we lock you up on defense, we score at will on offense, and there's nothing you can do about it, because the minute you try to limit one of our guys, we got four others who can go out there and get buckets. And now that they've got the bench, I think, trying to be a little bit more engaged at both ends of the floor, you have even more problems when Tatum and Brown take a seat. So I expect game four to be very lopsided in the Celtics' favor. I really do.
Damn, Sherrod, you got a brother hungry with some original Kentucky Fried Chicken. I know that's not one of our sponsors, but damn, Sherrod.
Yeah, I got that for you, Gary.
Drew.
Who can order the curtain? That's before your time. Before it's KFC, your parent, your grandbaby be like, well, go get some Kerr.
Is that a brand?
No, Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Oh, I see.
But the Colonel was the logo, like the dude, right?
Yeah.
Colonel Sanders. So your grandma would be like, go get some Colonel Sanders. Like, if I said that now to a 20-year-old,
you would
like,
not know what you're talking about.
That was Colonel Sanders. But that was the guy who did all the ads. Right. So go get some Colonel for me. Go get some Colonel Sanders. So that's old school. So original recipe, by the way. Anyway, I think that they're going to have to fight in game four. I think Miami, one thing I know, Miami's doing a lot of talking. You know, they're talking about, well, you know, Hero's upset. Oh, they was pushing me around and grabbing my jersey. Kevin Love said, we're going to have a way better game plan. Like, the Celtics aren't doing a lot of talking, which I think is good. Like, just be quiet and ball, hoop. Like, don't worry about what, you know, Miami's doing all this. Oh, they're underestimating us. And, you know, we have the culture and all that. Let them talk. Go out there and punch first. And just understand you're going to come up with it. Miami's going to try to blitz. Miami's going to change some things. They're going to try to make some serious adjustments because they're desperate. They know they can't go down 3-1. And so withstand that, because I don't think Miami is good enough to go up on them 20 points unless the Celtics are just not there mentally and just missing, you know, going 2-for-30, 2-for-25 to start the game. Miami just doesn't have that much offense, but they do have enough offense, enough strong enough defense to make it, you know, 45-45. 50-50, 52-50 throughout the game, then come down to the last final possessions, try to win 96-93. Like, they're good enough for that. So don't let that happen. Whip the ball around, use your ball movement, use your talented players, get to the free throw line, get some easy points, get to the rim, and just withstand that early charge. Once you do that, I think you'll be fine, because I think Sherrod touches on something that's very important. I think that there's, like, eventually Miami's going to have to understand that they don't have enough left. And I think when you look at the playoffs, right, and you see some of these teams kind of throw in the towel, I'm not saying Miami's going to quit, but, like, you look at New Orleans in game three against Oklahoma City, where if they go get the dub, it's 2-1, they're still in the series, they just didn't have it. You know, same with Phoenix against Minnesota. Eventually a team realizes if you keep the pressure on, we don't have enough. We just don't have enough. And you want to push Miami to that point. Don't let them get life. Don't let them get a win. All of a sudden, all the pressure's on winning game five, and you got to come back to Miami. Focus. And I just think the Heat will be focused. It's up to the Celtics to match that focus and exceed that focus and just – understand that they're the better team and they need to play like it.
Well, we'll see what game four actually brings us. And we want to thank, of course, the listeners, viewers, for sticking with us, the Big 3 NBA podcast. We'll be back soon. For A. Sean Blakely and Gary Washburn, I'm Bonnie Lopez.